Welcome to the Benefits Beat, the podcast that helps you navigate the complex world of benefits and employee health. Together, we're going to deep dive into the industry, breaking down the barriers and exploring different topics surrounding benefits and employee health. We will be bringing in subject matter experts who will share their knowledge, offering tips and tricks to help you understand and, more importantly, benefit from your benefits. Whether it's health insurance, dental, vision, disability, or other lines of coverage, we've got you covered. So join your hosts, Caroline and Zach, every 2 weeks as we explain the nuances, all in an effort to make it easier for you to navigate the world of benefits and improve your health. Today, we've got James Schlotnick here with Sun Life. We actually just listened to him talk for an hour or so around some legislative changes, but wanted to do a quick introduction, really give you a background into what James does, what he represents for Sun Life, what he represents for employers and benefits policies across the country. James, would you mind just telling us a little bit about your background, how long you've been with Sun Life, et cetera?
Yeah, I've been at Sun Life forever, about 21 years, for the last eight running our government relations function. So we have state and federal lobbyists, and we're focused on employee benefit issues that affect us as insurers, but also HR professionals and the broker consultant community as well.
And you are a top 100 lobbyist. Did I hear that correctly?
So in 2021, I think I was a top 100 lobbyist. I've obviously fallen off the rankings. I'm not sure where I am at this point. But at one point, yes, and have been on the Hill's top lobbyist list for a couple of years as well.
That's awesome. What does a typical day look like for you? I'm curious, kind of from day-to-day perspective, what you do, where you spend your time, who you talk to, that sort of thing.
It's such a cliche answer, but every day is very different. At Sun Life, we have a team, so we have a person who lives in D.C., Carson Lewis, that focuses on federal issues. We also have two dedicated state lobbyists as well, Lawless Barrientos and Lauren Overton. And my day is trying to figure out what they think are the most important issues, and if I can help in any of those issues, I jump on them. But every day is different. It could be flying out to Ohio to talk to clients about what the election could mean, and could be going to a state house to talk about why dental loss ratios don't make sense, or it could be talking to Hill staff about why a federal paid family medical leave program should include insurers.
Awesome. Well, I know from our listeners' perspective, we've got a lot of employees from our client employer groups that tune in, and lots of eyes on ears on the election, obviously, big thing coming up in about 41 days or so. So from an employee benefits perspective, what are kind of the key things that they might need to be aware of as an employee versus employer, or even both?
It's going to be a close election. No surprise, no breaking news there. One thing that we've been trying to make sure everyone, wherever you are in the benefits ecosystem, understands, just there are so many issues that are non-benefits related that they're probably going to dominate the next 100, 150 days of the next administration. The national debt is something that has to be dealt with in the first, maybe 3 months or so of the next administration, and there's a number of tax items that are expiring at the end of the year. And while those might not have direct impact on the employee benefit side of things, it is important that people realize there are a lot of other items that are going to be the focus of whether it's President Harris or President Trump. Those two issues in particular are going to take up a significant amount of time in the first year for them.
And you mentioned a couple of areas that, although there's not a ton of bills getting to a federal level and in the president's desk, that there's a lot of stuff happening at a state level. And in particular, you mentioned, too, the FMLA and then a little bit of the long-term disability that is really just going to be handled at the state level or possibly at a federal level. But could you dive into, when you look at the FMLA, when you look at the different benefits that are not handled on a federal level but rather versus the states, how does each state approach that differently, and why is there so many different differences between the states and how they handle it?
Yeah, and that's a good cleanup of that last answer, where maybe there's not a lot of benefit action on the federal level, but you're totally right. On the state level, that really is where the action is. When you look at the number of states that have one party that controls both the governor's office and the legislative branch, it's something like 40 of the states have a trifecta where there's one party in control. And so there is a lot more activity on that level than on the federal side of the house. From a paid leave perspective, things are starting to slow down a little bit on the statutory paid leave side of things. So there's now 13 states in D.C. that have statutory programs. And when you look at the next places that might have statutory programs, maybe Michigan, maybe New Mexico, but we're probably reaching the sort of the saturation point for the statutory paid family medical leave programs. What's interesting, though, is obviously that leaves a lot of other space, and you're starting to see insurers like Sun Life and others create new insurance products where it's not going to be a requirement for employers to offer these products, but they could. And family leave insurance is one of those one of the new products. So it works. It's priced and would be integrated into a program similar to short-term disability, except where short-term disability is for your own medical condition. Family leave insurance is providing insurance when your spouse has a child and you want to bond with them, or if you have a sick loved one or family member. So that's the innovation that the insurance industry is driving, where there's not going to be these requirements necessarily on the state level for family leave, but there are lots of states that don't have these requirements. And if employers don't want to self-fund the benefit, which can be expensive if you have 50, 100 employees, you might not be able to afford that. Mm-hmm. There's these new insurance options that are starting to pop up. So that's certainly one place that we're spending a fair amount of time.
And when do we expect those to start hitting to the employee level, right? When should they start educating themselves prior to, so they're not going into open enrollment into the new year with just zero, hey, do I take this, do I not? What we try to do is really just try to educate around, here's what's available to you, here's how you utilize it, here's when it may come in handy, here's when it may be not a fit for you or your family.
You're likely to see more benefit consultants, insurance companies start to talk about these products in 2025. So, you know, Sun Life's a good example. So we have a family leave insurance product that we can offer in 9 or 10 states right mm-hmm. now. But it's in infancy. We're not marketing it too much as we get the product approvals in all the states. But next year, you'll start to see it. And it's really, it's almost more at the HR decision maker level of, I would like to offer 4 weeks of time off if someone has a sick loved one. I can't afford to self-fund it, but I could afford to purchase something that costs about the same as short-term disability. They can go out on that leave. Sun Life or the insurance company is going to pay that. So you're likely to see more activity in that space, and people start to hear more about that in 2025. I know, and I've looked at surveys that some of our competitors have done, and just from talking to different HR decision makers, paid leave is a benefit that people are interested in and are trying to find ways. And employers are trying to find ways to offer it. Again, there just wasn't an actual insurance product that existed, but now it does. So I think you'll start to see that more, probably not this open enrollment season, but into 2025, the 2026? 2020,
yep.
Yeah, benefit year.
So we're
already talking about 2026.
That's right.
Yeah.
So it sounds like it'll act a lot like a short-term disability, where you're going to be offered this product, employer may pay for it, you may have to opt into it, and it's just something that you choose. Is this right for my family? Is this not? Or again, is your employer providing it for you?
Yeah, so this the way that we're seeing it being marketed, at least on the Sun Life side of things, is it is a 100% participation product. The employer pays for it. And it really is for those employers that are saying, I want to offer this, but I don't know how to afford it today. Now, you might be able to budget for a $300 a year premium versus, you know, thousands of dollars mm-hmm. a week when someone is out.
Now, would these types of products be a full income replacement, or could it be structured like short-term and long-term where you can do a percentage of salary?
Probably, again, there's different flexibility of what you can do, but we're envisioning it being very similar to a short-term disability or a long-term disability income replacement.
Gotcha.
Why is there so many? So we mentioned there's 13 different statutes on family paid medical leave. Why is there not just a national program to say, hey, everybody's going to be handled this way instead of all these different nuances from both an employee perspective, if they're working in multiple states, or an employer perspective when they're having to administer all these?
It's the million-dollar question. And if Vice President Harris is elected and there was a Democratic House and a Democratic Senate, you certainly could see Democrats try to advance a national program. Now, again, that's for the voters to decide. The challenge, though, is if you go back in time to 2021, the Biden administration tried to work a bill through that was called Build Back Better. And Build Back Better became the Inflation Reduction Act, not a straight line, but many of the concepts ended up in the Inflation Reduction Act. What didn't end up in the Inflation Reduction Act, though, is the 4-week national paid family medical leave program that was in Build Back Better. And I think what makes this frustrating for multi-state employers is what Build Back Better would have done is there would still would have been this, all the statutory programs. They would have continued as is. And then there would have been this additional program that every state that didn't have a statutory program would get. So you still would have ended up with 14 different programs. Mm-hmm. Just there wouldn't be new state ones coming up. And, you know, states, what you've seen the evolution of paid family and medical leave on the state side, and why every state is different, is states have tried to learn from maybe the mistakes of their predecessors. And so you've seen income replacement rates, which used to be, say, flat 60%, where you've seen over the last 5 years as the states passing these laws are having progressive income replacement rates. So the lowest wage workers are getting maybe 100% or 90%, and higher wage learners are getting that 60%. So again, I'm not saying it's right or wrong, that's just the evolution. And then even things like the definition of family has evolved over time. So if it's sort of just there, because these things didn't happen all at once, the states that have gone a little bit later have tried their best to sort of build on what the other states have done. But to your point, that now means that there's 13 states in D.C. that have programs that, you know, in the grand scheme of things are similar, but are all very, very different to administer.
So I think from our listeners' point of view, it's something that people are trying to get instituted, but it just may not be feasible in the short term.
There's different – I mean, there's a lot of work at the federal level on paid family medical leave. There's a bipartisan paid family medical leave or paid family leave working group in the House. There's a bipartisan paid family leave working group in the Senate. There's even a bicameral, meaning like they come together, I guess, you know, from both the House and the Senate. You know, and those folks meet. And they have a lot of great ideas. It's just so difficult. It's almost that we've almost waited too long for a national program because these other programs are so entrenched. There's a lot of discussion of how to make a national program, but it just feels like we're past the point of where that actually is a possibility.
Awesome. Thank you, James. So another thing that you discussed in the presentation earlier was about long-term disability and the Mental Health Parity Act. Can you maybe give our listeners a summary of what changes could be coming up to that?
Yeah, with long-term disability products, the business or the HR decision maker gets to go to the insurer and basically decide what the maximum duration of a mental health or mental nervous claim is going to be. So it could be the duration is no longer than 1 year or 2 years, or it could be just as long as it's medically necessary. The evolution of the industry over time is that the tradition has been that there's a 2-year duration limitation on these types of claims. And last year, the ERISA Advisory Council, which is made up of appointed individuals by the Department of Labor, they looked at why long-term disability does not have mental health parity. And their recommendation was that either at the state level or the federal level, there is mental health parity. And just to take a step back, there wasn't always mental health parity in health insurance. And then in the early 2000s, there was a federal law that required that. And, you know, even today, just a few days ago, there's new regulations coming out from the Biden administration around mental health parity on the health insurance side. So it's not like that is a perfect system.
And when you say mental health parity, you just mean that it's treated exactly the same as a broken arm or
right.
a broken mm-hmm. leg, something along those lines.
Right. So that there's not a artificial limitation that's put in place where the coverage ends whether the condition is over or not. Now, clearly, diagnosing mental health conditions are different than diagnosing a broken arm. Now, I'm just a lobbyist. I'm not a doctor, so you know I won't get into those details. But I think, again, over the last 30 years, mental health diagnoses have become a little sharp. The medical profession has advanced, and there's just you can sort of tell a little bit more. It's not as opaque as maybe it was, you know, 10, 20, 30 years ago. But the industry has not changed where mental health conditions after 2 years are generally not provided with coverage. And again, the industry is happy to provide coverage as long as someone requires it. It's that you can write into the policy that there's this artificial limitation. And so the ERISA Advisory Council looked at that and said, you know, that doesn't really make a lot of sense. We shouldn't treat mental health conditions different than you would any other condition. And so they put out a recommendation, again, state or federal level, there should be some type of requirement around this. And from a Sun Life perspective, and I can certainly only speak for us, we think this is the right thing to do, and we think a federal standard makes a lot of sense, because just what we were talking about a minute ago, what we don't want to see is long-term disability mental health parity turn into a similar situation as paid family medical leave, where there's 13 different states that they do it a little bit different. It's really hard to administer if you're a multi-state employer. If you have a federal standard, yes, there's this new requirement that is sitting on top of everything, but it's the same regardless of where you live. And so that avoids some of that confusion and, again, some of the administrative burden that folks have. And so, you know, we expect that at some point this year or maybe early next year, we could see some legislative activity on this on the federal level. We've already seen some legislative action on the state level with no state yet requiring LTD mental health parity. Vermont's an outlier. They've had LTD mental health parity since 2008. I think though, because of the size of the state, you haven't seen it spread. But putting Vermont aside for a moment, we've seen states look at this, but we haven't had seen anyone that's crossed that that threshold yet. But 2025, excuse me, legislative sessions, we certainly expect to see some states look at this. And again, wouldn't be surprised after the ERISA Advisory Council recommendation to see a federal legislation introduced as well.
Yeah, to your point about the multi-state having each different statutory limit or certain way that they're handling it, I think about us in Cincinnati. We have people that are working in Cincinnati but may live in Ohio, may mm-hmm. live in Kentucky, may mm-hmm. live in Indiana, or even just the working, right? You have a construction job that you're getting the taxes and all that good stuff because you did a job in this one specific locality,
right,
whatever the case is. But I can't imagine having, as an employee, to figure out, hey, how does this apply to me, even though I work across state lines, but I live here, and then I do some other work across this state line and all the differences between there. There's one last thing that I wanted to touch on that we'll kind of end up on. I think it's the biggest thing that people are probably aware about so far that's already been passed. It's the Medicare and negotiating pharmacy costs, and I think it was passed in 2023. Starting in 2026, Medicare will be able to negotiate costs with pharmacy and with drugs.
Sure.
Now, while these are not a ton of drugs, they're the ones that are the most utilized by the American taxpayer and health insurance providers, et cetera. How is that going to impact, from an employee's perspective, my pocketbook, my coverage? How does that impact an everyday utilizer of the healthcare system?
Right, and if you turn on the TV and you listen to Vice President Harris or any of her surrogates, they're talking quite a bit about how the Inflation Reduction Act allows Medicare to negotiate the price of prescription drugs and how this is going to lower, with some other provisions as well, lower seniors' prescription drug prices. To your point, that doesn't feel like it impacts us at all. We're on the commercial side. It has nothing to do with us. What the concern is, there's some type of cost-shifting environment that is created by this applying to just Medicare and not the commercial side of things. And what I mean by that is the Congressional Budget Office, and these are the folks in D.C., they're the accountants, they run the numbers for the government to figure out what they project the economic and fiscal impact of legislation will be. When they looked at the Inflation Reduction Act, they said, great news. With this provision in place and another one that caps the price increases that pharmaceutical companies can charge to Medicare, by 2030, when everything's fully implemented, the government is going to spend about $32 billion less on prescription drug costs for Medicare than they would have if the Inflation Reduction Act right. didn't exist. So that feels good. Hey, we're spending less. Seniors are spending less. Drug prices are going down. The flip side of that, though, and listen, I'm not an economist, and I don't run a PBM, and I don't run a pharmaceutical company. I'm just an insurance company lobbyist. But when we looked at that number, we said, huh, that means that the pharmaceutical companies are going to get $32 billion less than they would have if the Inflation Reduction Act didn't exist. Where does that money go? It doesn't feel like the...
Doesn't feel like they're just going to take it.
Yeah. And so the challenge then is, okay, well, does the Inflation Reduction Act stop any type of cost shift? And the answer is no. It doesn't apply to the commercial market at all. Now, these drugs, as you pointed out, they're not the high-cost biologic drugs. They're relatively, I'm using air quotes here, that works really well on a podcast, low-cost prescription drugs. They're the highest utilized drugs. They cumulatively cost Medicare the most amount of money. But, you know, they range anywhere from $175 to a vote, a dose, to, you know, $10,000 to a dose. So these aren't, you know, million-dollar drugs. And so Sun Life, a stop-loss provider, we had our stop-loss folks look at this, and they said, well, you know, these particular drugs, even if they went up in cost two, three, four times, these aren't going to drive stop-loss claims. These are not the types of drugs that are driving these type of claims. And so we are interested in how this will impact first dollar claims. Again, if XYZ drug, and, you know, I don't have the list of drugs in front of me, but if you go on the CMS website, they've listed them out. They've listed out what they project the savings is for each and every drug. If you're taking one of those today and you see the government says they're going to save $150 a dose on these going forward, is there some incentive for the pharmaceutical company to shift mm-hmm. those dollars over to the commercial side of things? Now, because I don't run a PBM, Sun Life's not a PBM. I'm sure there's a lot of strategies that that you can put in place so that's not going to impact those first dollar claims. But I think that's a legitimate unknown, and could end up being a significant unintended consequences of the Inflation Reduction Act, where maybe it is going to reduce seniors' drug costs, but does it have an unintended consequence of increasing commercial drug prices?
And I think as a utilizer of healthcare, it's something to be knowledgeable about, at least, right? We're always cynical when it comes to insurance, when it comes to costs and how much it costs me out of pocket to just get a drug that I need. And everybody's complaining about drug costs, but understanding how we got there, whether it's the hospital system, whether it's legislative changes around, hey, this may increase my out-of-pocket cost, even if it's a couple dollars, it's good to know that background on how we got here.
Yeah, and again, this is not fully implemented until 2026. A lot right. can change sure. between now and then. But if you look at the press releases that CMS is putting out, if you look at the way Vice President Harris and her surrogates are talking about this on the campaign trail, Medicare negotiating the price of prescription drugs is a significant accomplishment of the Biden administration that they are touting quite a bit. And so, again, we'll just have to see if there's any unintended consequences mm-hmm. on the commercial side.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Super helpful information, and we are very fortunate and grateful to have your expertise and appreciate you taking the time. And good luck with the lobbying.
Yeah, I feel like I'm on NPR. We're in a studio. We've got headphones on. This has been great. Thank you both very much.
Thanks, James. Thanks. Nothing we say in this podcast is representative of any specific plan and should not be considered as legal, regulatory, or accounting advice. If there are any discrepancies between what we say and your plan document will prevail. If you have any questions about your benefits, please reach out to your HR representative.